Call the March 23rd meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order. Good morning, committee members. Happy Friday. And I will open a work session for possible reconsideration on House Bill 2910. And Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 2910.
Representative Buckley moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 2910. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, then the rules are suspended. And Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, thanks, members of the committee. I move that we reconsider House Bill 2910.
Representative Buckley moves to reconsider House Bill 2910. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries, and the measure is once again before the committee. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to pull back this bill and to offer the Dash 2 amendments, which would take away the retroactivity part of the bill, which did cause concern.
Representative Buckley, did you? I would like to make a motion.
Madam Chair,
I think it was a political speech for myself.
I just want to say thanks, Madam Chair. I move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Buckley moves adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2910. Mr. Shepard, would you please explain what this amendment would do?
If you look at the bill, you will see sections 2 and 3 address that retroactive penalty waiver, and the amendment merely takes sections 2 and 3 out. It renumbers section 4 to be number 2 and maintains the original, the first part of that, which is to direct political committee statements of organization to include designation of a person other than the treasurer to also receive notices sent to the treasurer.
And Mr. Stenbridge, does this also delete the retroactivity?
It does.
Okay.
So that is what this amendment would do. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, we're on adoption of the Dash 2 amendments. And will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Berger. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Rosenbaum. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, without making another speech, I move House Bill 2910 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Bill 2910 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? The clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative
Buckley. Aye.
Representative
Hunt. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Buckley, would you like to carry this bill?
Madam Chair, that or we could put on consent, whatever you would prefer. I'd be happy to carry it if you'd like me to.
I think that we should make sure people understand what we're doing. So okay. Why don't we have you carry it?
Thank you. I'd be honored.
Okay. Great. So we will conclude the work session on House Bill 2910. And let's see here. I'll open a work session on House Bill 27. Are we ready to do this?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Concurrent Resolution 10. Mr. Stenbridge, please.
Chair Rosenbaum, HCR 10 honors Robert Y. Thornton, who lived from 1910 to 2003, as one of Oregon's most distinguished public servants of the 20th century.
Thank you. And Representative Berger, would you like to come forward?
Madam Chair, may I bring my
an esteemed colleague?
Colleague with me.
Yes, please do.
Sort of share the honors here, if you don't mind.
Great. Good morning.
For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, friends and colleagues. If you've read this resolution, I think you get a flavor for how influential this gentleman was in a sort of an era that, looking around this room, none of us lived and worked with Robert Y. Thornton in this building, but you can see by this bio how much time he spent as a patriot, as a vet in World War II, coming back to Oregon, serving in this body, serving one of the longest runs as Attorney General in our state's history. But what I know him for was when I was sort of a young person involving myself in civic matters in Salem. At the time, Japan was sort of the trading partner on the West Coast, and before their economy went south, it was really critical and an important economic tool for Oregon to be connected with Japan. And this gentleman spoke Japanese, he knew the Japanese, he wrote about the Japanese, and he was incredibly influential in making us part of that economic sort of cross ocean peace to make Oregon's economy grow with the Japanese connection. And that's what that's when I first knew him. And I didn't realize till later that was his after interest. After he had done all the things that are listed here, then he went on to serve the state just as a private citizen, going back and forth across the ocean trying to connect Oregon and Japan in some really unique ways. I'll tell one other personal story and then quit. There are many people in this building who remember him well. When I went to Jackie, I had about 2 minutes to get signatures on this bill because it landed on my desk the day of filing day. And I went over to and asked Jackie Winters. She literally came out of her sick bed to get signed onto this bill. She was so excited that we were doing this for Robert Thornton. His son, by the way, was a retired state policeman who was serving my first session as one of the guys in the back of the room. His son, Tom's son, Robert Y.'s grandson, was the first honorary page I ever introduced in this building. So for all those reasons, I'm here, and I've brought with me a gentleman who served more closely with Robert Y. Thornton. And so I'll close and turn it over to somebody who knew him more personally.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Berger. And we are honored to have former Representative and former State Senator Mannix with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem, an attorney in private practice and a former member of this body. And I appreciate the opportunity to briefly share with you a couple of thoughts about the person I knew as Judge Thornton. And I say unabashedly that he was a great Democrat. He represented the Tillamook area in the legislature, went on to become Attorney General, served with distinction as Attorney General, then was one of the first judges on the Oregon Court of Appeals when that body was formed, and served until his retirement from that court. Then after he retired, as Representative Berger spoke, he worked closely with Japan. And where did that connection come from? During World War II, he had served in the Aleutians as an interpreter for the U.S. Army. He had been trained in Japanese, and his job was to conduct interviews with Japanese prisoners. And then in post-war Japan, he was assigned to assist with the occupation and used his Japanese skills there. So he is one of Oregon's quiet giants, one of the people that wasn't full of pizzazz in terms of the public eye is concerned, but was a devoted public servant who served us internationally as well as at the state scene. I came to know Judge Thornton as a law clerk when I first arrived in Oregon because he was one of the Court of Appeals judges. I clerked for Judge Robert Foley on the Court of Appeals. Got to know Judge Thornton at that time and continued to work with him later when I was a state representative because he would come to this building building to work on some issues of concern and would visit. And I was not his representative. I was in an adjoining district, but he had known me as a young law clerk, and so he felt that he could come and speak to me. And his wife, Dorothy Thorne, was an accomplished artist and photographer, known in this community for those skills. I mention these things to bring a little bit more of the human sense to the persona who's presented to you in this resolution. And I thank you for your consideration of it, and I urge its passage.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions?
Just a comment.
Yes, Vice Chair Beckley.
I've never seen a resolution yet. This is only my second session, but in the resolution on line 27, they refer to Mr. Judge Thornton as a credit to the human race. And that's delightful. That's delightful.
If I could, yes, Madam Chair. We need to always be mindful. I did not realize until I started reading through all the things that he did for this. I think Kevin hit it. Quite a giant. Sometimes people don't, this is too late. We should have been doing this quite a while ago, because this fellow devoted himself to this state and its interests for a lifetime. This is way overdue.
Well, thank you very much for bringing it forward. Thank you for your testimony. And I understand the family could not be here this morning.
They could not. Tom Thornton is still doing police work, and I hope to gather his family to hear this on the floor.
And we'll certainly work with them to make sure that that happens. Okay. So we are in a work session, and we'll wait for a moment for Representative Berger to rejoin us. Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Do adopt recommendation. Representative Berger moves House Concurrent Resolution 10 be sent to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? The clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Motion carries.
And
Madam Chair.
Yes.
We have one question, though. Representative Buckley and I are from Southern Oregon, and I see he married a Haberlatch. Is that any relation to Judge Haberlatch in Southern Oregon?
I can certainly find out.
Representative Berger, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I would be very honored.
Great. We will have you as the carrier then. And let's see what else we've got here. We do have one bill where we're waiting for someone to join us at 9 o'clock. So while we're doing that, perhaps we can open a work session on House Bill 2762.
Chair Rosenbaum, you heard this bill on the 19th, which was Monday. It clarifies that a person who resides in a shelter, park, motorhome, marina, or other location who is otherwise qualified to vote may register to vote and may use the office of the county clerk as the mailing address.
And I believe that we had testimony at that time from a county clerk on behalf of the county clerks expressing support for this bill. Is that correct?
This might be.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, that is correct. Linda Smith, the Klamath County Clerk, on behalf of the county clerks, was offering support of the bill. And I do think it's wonderful that we do have a bill that we have to have to fight the clerks over, and they're actually supportive of and feeling good about.
That is a nice change. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't here, I guess, during, it must have been a very short testimony. I must have missed it. However, was there any mention of a fiscal impact?
Mr. Stembridge. Have we had a fiscal impact?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember whether there was no fiscal impact or minimal. I believe that it's no fiscal impact, but there's a small cost of registering these folks, so there might be a minimal impact.
Okay. Good. Okay. Is there a motion? Representative Roblin, discussion.
So if that's their mailing address, they wouldn't have to stop by the post office to pick it up, I guess. Is that what they're basically saying?
Correct.
Okay.
It's himself. And is there a motion, Vice Chair Buckley?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2762 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Buckley moves House Bill 2762 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative
Klein. Aye.
Representative Factor.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And we need a carrier. Is there a volunteer? Perhaps someone new would like to do this?
Do you want to consent on this one?
Consent.
Thank you.
Hey, Kim. Representative Thatcher. Would you like to carry this bill?
Carry it? I'll take a consent, which sounds good to me, too. But I suppose I can carry a bill for this committee.
Right. There may not be many other opportunities.
That's right. I'm on the right committee this morning.
Okay,
three for three.
So that's yes?
Sure.
Great. Okay, we will have Representative Thatcher carry this bill then. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2762. And with our impeccable timing, I will open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 32. Mr. Stembridge.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, HJR 32. Is a referral to the voters. Upon approval by voters at the November 2008 general election, amends the Oregon Constitution to allow circulation of initiative petitions for at least 2 full years after the dates they are approved for circulation by the Secretary of State.
Thank you for that explanation. And we have a sign-up sheet. And do we have anybody further than 100 miles? I don't see anybody. Let's start with Brenda Bays from the Secretary of State's office. And members, this did come out of some of our discussions on initiative reform earlier, so I think this concept may be familiar to you. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. The Secretary of State Elections Division is neutral regarding HJR 32. However, we do have a few concerns that we would like to address to the committee. It is not clear to our office if the intent of this resolution is to allow chief petitioners to have 2 years to circulate an initiative petition or more than 2 years. For example, if a chief petitioner is approved to circulate in August of 2010 and they have obtained the required number of signatures and submit them to our office in August of 2012, they would have missed the four-month deadline for the 2012 general election. It would then seem that they would, if they have submitted enough signatures, they would be qualified for the 2014 general election. Could the chief petitioners collect additional signatures if it is found that they do not have the sufficient number of signatures to qualify for the 2014 general election ballot? Or does this allow them to keep collecting signatures until a general election in which they would like their initiative to appear on? Is it that once they have submitted the required number of signatures to our office, and if the initiative does not have sufficient signatures, must they then start the process again? Our office would respectfully ask the committee to provide in statute a mechanism for our office to track these initiatives that may continue to gather signatures from one general election cycle to the next. Currently, statutes provide that chief petitioners of city and county initiatives are to notify elections officials that the initiative petition is still active if they are gathering signatures. We respectfully ask the committee to consider that for state initiatives as well. This will help us be able to inform citizens who may contact our office to inquire into these initiatives, and it would also help us in the workload process for verifying these signatures when they are submitted. These requirements are currently set out in ORS 250.165 sub 7 for county initiatives and 250.265 sub 7 for city initiatives. Additionally, this office has questions regarding the process. The resolution states that the Secretary of State shall complete the verification process not later than 30 days after the last day on which the petition may be filed. If the chief petitioner submits the signatures in August 2012, excuse me, and they have missed a four-month period for the general election, when would our office have to have the signature verification completed for that initiative? In other words, would we have to, while we're verifying the ones that made it in time for the 2012, would we also have to verify the one for 2014 at the same time? And finally, we do have concerns regarding voter confusion, that the electors may not understand what election this initiative may appear on, or that an elector may have forgotten that they've already signed a particular petition and may sign the same petition again maybe 3 or 4 years later. This, as you know, is a violation of Oregon election law. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to bring these questions forward, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions the committee may have for me.
Thank you for your testimony. So is it your reading of this bill, then, that it would allow these petitions to be in circulation for an indefinite period of time, the way it's currently drafted?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, it is unclear if that is the intent of this HDR.
I don't think that was. Well, I don't know. I guess we've got the sponsor, one of them, sitting on the committee, so perhaps he can shed some light.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Buckley?
The intent is to allow for 2 years, not for indefinite signature gathering, or, you know. I do understand the confusion from reading that the line 25, when it says for at least 2 years, does seem to indicate that it could be at least two and as many as 40, which was not the intent.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question. As I read it, and I was under the impression that Representative Buckley had that it would be 2 years, and that's what you get. From your office, you would have to have a new date for every petition that you had to track. And so then at the end of the 2 years, they've either got it in or it's done, if the 2 years was done. Is that a big problem for your office to track each individual one, as opposed to now we know 4 months before, if they don't have it in, it's done? So does that become a problem for you guys?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, I won't say that it would be a big problem.
Okay.
Currently, as you say, we have a mechanism that if it isn't turned in by the deadline for signature verification, it's finished. We would have to make some modifications to our database to track these, but I don't believe it would be a problem.
Okay,
and
yes, Vice Chair
Buckley. Just to comment on that, if you go to the Secretary of State's website, which I don't know if you have seen, you can see the date.
When it started.
Yeah, you can see the date.
It would just be a date at the end when it has to be done by.
Correct.
It would be added to it.
Correct.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll call Greg Wasson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Greg Wasson, founder, executive secretary, and 50% of the Committee for Petition Rights. So my membership has grown doubled since the last I was before you.
Representative Roblin.
And I just want to note the bill we took care of this morning means that both of the people in your committee will now be. We were concerned if you only had one, how are you going to get that one? We appreciate the fact that you've done this.
Well, I hope that as the word of my existence gets out, I will have more people joining. But am afraid that the present reforms that this committee came into this session to enact on the initiative process failed to account for the true history of the initiative. During initiative discussions in the last 10 years, I've heard often that in the old days this was a grassroots tool, and that's not true. The initiative was never soft and cuddly. Big out-of-state money came in on Oregon initiatives starting in 1908. And in fact, there was such an uproar of this Pennsylvania millionaire funding William S. Uren that the People's Power League decided not to take out-of-state money anymore. So the problems of out-of-state money in initiative campaigns in Oregon almost has existed since the very beginning. I would like the committee to think about the task facing Uren and his fellows in the late 1800s. The only way to get the initiative amendment was to convince members of this body to put something on the ballot that they knew would reduce their power. Not only that, but in those days, constitutional amendments had to be approved by two successive sessions of the legislature before it went on the ballot. I think it's a mark of how dissatisfied Oregonians were with a pure representative government that a bunch of people were able to convince the legislature to two sessions of the legislature to put it on the ballot, and then it was approved 11-1. So we have tried pure representative democracy in this state, in this country, and it didn't work. And as I told you last time, the initiative was written not to work with the representative legislature, but to frustrate it and circumvent it. In 1904, the direct primary law eventually allowed Oregonians to become the first citizens in the country to elect their U.S. senators. In 1906, the local initiative was added, and the home rule amendment was added. In 1908, the recall power was added. In 1910, the People's Power League successfully pushed two initiatives that removed power. The legislature used to be able to remove sitting justices from the Oregon Supreme Court. But in 1910, the judicial clause was rewritten to take that power away, and also to take away the power of the legislature to pass taxes. All taxes had to be referred to the ballot. That was in 1910. And in that year, Uren declared war on the existing economic and political elite of Oregon. And given his track record, in less than 10 years, they had remade every part of state government. So when he declared war on when he pledged to change the seating arrangement on the gravy train, he had to be taken seriously. In 1912, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to take jurisdiction of two Supreme Court cases originating in Oregon, which made state Supreme Courts the true courts of last resort as concerns most initiative questions. The 1913 legislature responded by packing the Oregon Supreme Court with a majority that could be trusted to cut Uren off at his knees. This PAC court dismissed with Uren, but didn't address the underlying problems with the initiative amendment. And it has never been rewritten. And that leaves today's governors trapped in the negative catch-22. When initiative questions come before them, they can either pay attention to the Constitution and endorse a system designed to make it so the representative legislature doesn't work, and possibly help Oregon commit sovereignty suicide, But the alternative is to ignore the Constitution and perhaps turn their courts into political forums where the judges are announcing what the law ought to be rather than what the law is. Again, the Oregon petition law is a constitutional mess. When Senator Packwood's problems became well known, a number of people tried to circulate recall petitions against him. The Secretary of State turned to the Attorney General, who said, no, you can't recall a federal official. And so the petitions were not allowed even to be certified. That's not the rule of law. That one government official with no judicial decision to support him telling a government another government official that the people can't recall a third government official. That's not the rule of law. That's the bureaucratic version of the ultimate statement of discretion because I'm the mother. And I think that even people who don't have legal training are familiar with the tripartite separation of powers. But think about what happened there. The Attorney General, who was a legislative creation, it's not in the Constitution. The Secretary of State is a member of the Executive Department. The Executive Department turns to the Legislative Department to do a judicial decision. So that, you know, and constitutional law is a lot like being pregnant. You either do it or you don't. If the government ignores the Constitution a little bit of the time, it doesn't matter that it respects the Constitution most of the time. It's clear that the petition powers need to be updated and clarified. A special urgency, the initiative amendment should be rewritten to encourage the two lawmaking bodies, the representative legislature and the popular legislature, to work together. The popular legislature can be divided into two groups. One is people who want to use it to control government, and the other group is citizens who are interested in this public policy issue or that. This resolution deals only with the second group. Under the current system, citizens who first come to the legislature to plead their case burn about half of their signature collection time. Making the two-year limit rolling would remove that penalty. Encouraging activists to work with the legislature would have tangible benefit for the government as well. If the activists got satisfaction from the legislature, then that's one less issue that's on the ballot and one less petition that's being passed. If, in fact, their legislative excursion was not successful, then the bill that was drafted by people who write statutes for a living would likely become the words that they put in their ballot measure. So that there would be a benefit there. The rolling two-year limit would also reduce the commercial activity associated with the initiative process, since not everyone would be chasing signatures at the same time, would stop people from using the ballot title process and the Oregon Supreme Court as political tools to hassle initiative sponsors, which would say disagree, and would spread the workload of the Attorney General and Secretary of State over the year rather than requests for ballot titles and signature verification being crammed into this two-week period every other year. I would ask that the committee schedule a work session as soon as possible, because in much of this building I'm still Greg Hu, and I'm having a lot of trouble getting senators to talk to me while the bill is still in the House. I understand that that this resolution would become competing against other resolutions that need to be sent out, but that priority can be done in the Senate committee as well. As Ms. Buckley said, Representative Buckley said, we're only wanting 2 years. I would propose an amendment to this that would be a bit more poetic than the statutory. The language now says the timeline set out in subsection E. That was written by people who write statutes for a living, and it doesn't. Some people were writers before they went to law school, and they didn't get it drummed out of them. But Brenda talked about whether people would know what election an initiative is going to be voted on, and my response to that is that it's unimportant. The idea is what's important. In 54, the Supreme Court said that because the election mentioned in the petition had already passed. The court said, well, it's not really that important that it's going to be voted on at a subsequent election. And that's...
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Vice Chair Buckley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weston, you shouldn't take it personally. We have trouble getting senators to talk to us as well. can you talk a little bit about why place this in the Constitution? Why go this route?
Well, the problem with the initiative is that there are no constitutional lines telling the various government bureaucrats how to administer it. And so the whole idea of a constitution is to provide some direction of how things are happening. So that's important. Plus, just from a, we don't know in 10 years what the legislature is going to be, what their composition is going to be. So maybe they'll pull it back, you know. So it's just put it in the Constitution. And my passion for this is not so much the effect of the rolling 2-year limit, but just starting the discussion. If we want to attack people who are using the initiative to hassle government, the way to do that is to rewrite the basic structure of the initiative amendment, not make it harder to use. But this body does not have a real good reputation with the citizens in terms of the initiative process, and this would start as a neutral way to start the discussion, because 2 years from now, if you put out a resolution that would change the initiative structure to actually get at Bill 5 more, you need to have a track record that the people will be encouraged to trust you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your
thank
testimony.
You.
And next we'll call Philip Schradel. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Philip Schradel, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. The Department of Justice is neutral on this proposal. There are some benefits and some just logistical questions to be raised about it. The benefits that I think Mr. Wasson said, not so much today, but I think actually in the prior meeting I think we had with the committee, that a 2-year rolling period would alleviate a little bit of the concern or pressure that's put on litigating ballot titles. And I think there is some merit to that. Right now, our office, you know, is we have the responsibility for drafting ballot titles and defending them. And they get challenged quite often in the Oregon Supreme Court. And I think in part, some of that is because that period of time during which the ballot title is challenged is a hiatus in which nobody can gather signatures. And I think that does put some pressure on litigation so that people litigate for delay. If you had this kind of a proposal in place, I think it would alleviate to some extent some of that litigation pressure, because under this kind of a proposal, whenever the ballot title process was finally completed and the ballot title went back to the Secretary of State for authorization to go gather signatures, then it would kick in the two-year period. So there wouldn't be any benefit to the litigators to delay, other than maybe move the signature gathering process out, but it wouldn't impose any additional stress on the timeline for gathering signatures. The logistical questions, I think Ms. Bays from Secretary of State's office mentioned some of those, and I just wanted to amplify a couple of those. Right now, under the Secretary of State's process, when you're authorized to gather signatures, it does get designated for the election for which the measure is going to come up for the vote before the people. And there's a public policy purpose behind that requirement, which is that people can get subject to, and Ms. Bays mentioned this, subject to penalties for signing twice on the same initiative petition. Having it identified as to which election it's going to appear on helps people to understand, oh, I've already signed that one. There are other triggers, because there are numbers that are associated with it, too. We would need to just be cautious and careful going forward with a proposal like this to make sure that the statutes that are currently in place would get amended in such a way that the process would be seamless, so that there wouldn't be any conflicts between the current statutory requirements and then the processes that are used by the Secretary of State's office. One other question that was in the background of my mind, and I didn't hear Ms. Bays mention this to date, I don't think it would cause Secretary of State's office or our office any increase in terms of personnel costs. I think it would have the effect of smoothing out over the two-year cycle that we currently see the opportunities or the need for employee time within the Secretary of State's office. I think they've adapted to the current cycle, and there might be some things that would cause them to reallocate their assignments, but that's more for them to deal with. I do want to talk a little bit with the question that came up about the intent behind the proposal, because I do think there is a bit of ambiguity that is in the current language in the proposal. I had the same question that Ms. Bays raised, that is the intent behind it to set a two-year period, or is it to set a not less than two-year period? And if the intent is really to establish a two-year period, now, there might be other ways of drafting this, obviously, but one way of getting at it might be to just strike the two words "at least," because right now it talks about an initiative petition shall be filed not later than, and the date is significant because it is a definitive article, the date that is 4 months before the election and allows the petition to be circulated for 2 years. That would give a date certain, I think, to the proposal if that's the intent behind it. I think I should touch a little bit upon the fact that the current constitutional provision doesn't have explicit in it a timeline for gathering signatures. Our office issued an Attorney General opinion 40-some years ago that opined, and we would adhere to that today, that there is inherent in that a two-year period for gathering signatures because of all the rationale about the voter confusion, that the intent behind the signature gathering process is to have a showing of contemporaneous support for the measure, so that, you know, a 100-year-old signature shouldn't suffice to show contemporaneous support for the measure. So there has to be inherent in that some limitation. Now, there could be difference of opinion about what that limitation would be. This proposed measure would answer that question. And there, you know, if there is no limit, you know, if our Attorney General opinion is incorrect, then that would mean that there couldn't be a statutory proposal that would impose a limit because the Constitution would have no limit in it. And I think there might be at least arguments raised about whether you could do it by statute. So my caution to you would be, I think the appropriate approach would be through a House joint resolution such as before you, to refer a constitutional amendment to the vote of the people. And with that, I mean, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions, Vice Chair Berger.
Not a question, just a comment. The administrator and I were talking earlier, and that Attorney General report opinion was issued by Robert Y. Thornton.
Yes.
Great. Well, there's certainly something poetic about that. other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next we'll call Cappy Eaton. Morning.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee.
And I think you probably don't need the mic quite that close.
For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And appreciate the opportunity today to talk about raising a concern that we have with HJR 32. The League is a nonprofit. We are a nonprofit, but we're a nonpartisan citizen organization that encourages citizen participation in government, and that's one of the reasons that we're concerned. The League has for a long time supported the constitutional right of citizens to propose or revise statutes through the direct initiative process. That being said, our members, after study, came to the conclusion that 1 year for the circulation of petitions should be adequate. What we would like to do is support HJR 32 because we do think it should be in the Constitution, but we can only support it if the time period is changed to no longer than 1 year. We do believe, and we discussed this with you under House Bill 2082, that there are a number of revisions to the process that we think would improve the initiative process. It was interesting that Mr. Wasson brought up some of the history because Mr. Ewan had to go to some lengths, he and his group, to get the proposal before the public in the first place. They had to shut out all the Republicans, and so the populace could pass the bill in two sessions. And that whole history is very interesting as to how it even managed to get on the ballot in 1902. But I, in an aside, he did not mention initiatives that passed in 1912, which was the vote for women. I'm not sure whether he considered that an anomaly for the initiative process or not. But we do want to bring to your attention again some of the really important issues that we think you need to move forward and discuss. And that is the number of signatures needed for that initial petition of 25 of your closest best friends can get you a ballot title. And we believe that that needs to be changed, and we certainly would ask you to give that serious consideration. What the number is, I don't know, but we need to talk about that. And that could change the whole dynamics of whether or not you need to spend a lot of time challenging ballot titles. But that whole timeline does need to be looked at. And one of the things that was brought up by the Attorney General was the idea of sending an initiative out with a summary while it was waiting for the ballot title so that you didn't have to, if it were challenged, wait that period of time till it went through the process with the Supreme Court. So that's another thing for you to think about. And also, the adjustments to the paid petitioner requirements we believe are very important, and others that we hope you will continue to discuss. We would like to support this going out to the voters, but we need to have you amend it to 1 year rather than 2 years in order to do that. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony, and Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Eaton, thank you very much for your testimony. The difference between 1 year and 2 year, Can you tell me a little bit about what the concern of the league is about that?
Well, one of them has already been alluded to by Mr. Wasson, and that is voter confusion. We went into that when we're out there as volunteers passing petitions, because people will say, well, I can't remember for sure if I signed this. And this is in a much shorter period of time that we're talking about. If it's over 2 years, it's over a 2 year period, we're sure that there are people who are going to, we think there would be an increased number of people who actually sign a second time without realizing it. And we also think the costs to the petition process could increase if it's going to go over that period of time. Those kinds of things are bothering us about that. And I should say that the league spent a lot of time studying the initiative process and has reviewed it. And this was the result of my being here, is the fact that our members rather strongly said no more than 1 year.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments from committee members? And I did want to let you know that we continue to work on the initiative reform proposals that we have had a lot of testimony on. So I'm sure those will be coming up.
Thank you. We look forward to talking about those.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we have one more witness signed up, and that's Andrea Meyer. Would you please come forward?
Good morning. Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We are here today in opposition to HJR 32, although it's we appreciate that it's been clarified, because as we all read this, it seemed that someone could carry an initiative endlessly, and that would cause us, and hopefully many of you, grave concern. As I've testified previously before this committee, we are quite concerned as well about the initiative process, the ease in which the numbers of initiatives are filed, the ease in which one can amend the Oregon Constitution. And I want to be clear, sometimes the ACLU opposes amending the Constitution, and there are things that we would like to amend the Constitution to improve. So, you know, we approach that concern about making it harder from both sides. I think some things have been alluded to. The purpose is to capture the groundswell of support, and having people who, as you extend the time out for when something will appear on the ballot, you may have people who've signed an initiative. And I want to just try to use the cycle that was referenced by the Secretary of State. If you start collecting in 2010 for till 2012, but you don't qualify for the 12 election cycle, so it's 14 that it comes. That's a four-year period. You're dealing with a mobile society. People who've actually signed on to these have moved out of state, and they wouldn't be barred, is my understanding. Their signatures would count as long as they still appear on the rolls. I believe it's 5 years when they get off of the rolls. But it just, as we extend the time period from which a person originally signs to when the issue will be voted on by the elector, we increase or dissipate sort of the groundswell. I think the signing concerns that have been raised by a number of folks, including Ms. Eaton, about not remembering, I suffer from that, although I've generally made it a personal rule not to sign initiatives, so that makes it easy not to forget. But I do think that's a dynamic, and I think the one-year proposal is an interesting response and way to go. You know, I tend to believe the current process seems to work fine. I know Mr. Schradl talked about the concern of litigation and as a way to delay the process. I would hope anyone who is licensed under the Oregon State Bar has a duty to not engage in frivolous litigation. The ACLU is one of those entities that on occasion, I can't say frequently, but we do on occasion challenge ballot titles, and even this cycle, we had two ballot titles that were submitted by the same sponsor. We filed comments to the AG on both of them. On one, our comments were adequately addressed. We did not challenge to the Supreme Court. On the other, our comments were pretty resoundingly rejected. We did challenge to the Supreme Court, and as I vaguely recall, I think we were vindicated indeed. And most of the occasions when we file challenges to the Supreme Court, we are vindicated, including today. Albeit immodest, but the court has ordered the Attorney General to modify a ballot title that we did make comments on. But in terms of people sort of delaying the process, I think folks have already figured out how to address that. There is no deadline for or no bar on anyone filing an initiative and going through the whole process up to collecting certified signatures well before the two-year cycle begins. So, although it was let's just pick a date, July 6, 2006, when one could start collecting signatures for our 08 ballot measure, folks could file well before then. And as I testified to you before, that's being done with more frequency. And they can go through the whole process, be it because someone's delaying or be it because someone believes that the ballot title issued didn't adequately reflect the actual ballot title. They can conclude that process and then have 2 years. So this just extends it out and troubles us a great deal. The other aspect, I think, is it just becomes confusing as laws change. I mean, if we take the 2010-12 scenario again, someone files in 2010, and there'll be in a legislative cycle, and maybe the legislature will resolve their concerns. And if they do, they can withdraw it or not proceed. But let's say it doesn't in 2011. And, of course, this all becomes an interesting dynamic as we move into annual sessions. But let's assume we're in an every other year cycle, or even not. They then file in 2012, but again, after the deadline, so they can't appear on the 14. On the 12th cycle, but on the 14th. Well, if the legislature comes back and so you've got this thing, maybe they've produced all the signatures they need in 2012. They are concluded, their initiative is done. Well, what happens if the legislature makes changes in 2013 to that law? You know, you've engaged in something that's stagnant on the initiative process while there's a dynamic engagement going on the legislative process. And so I just raise these concerns as we spread the time out. I would agree with the League of Women Voters in my testimony earlier that I think the previous bill that's been before this committee to address some of the concerns about the initiative process makes some important changes to hopefully address some of the concerns we have about the process. And with that, I conclude. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Okay.
Thank you
very much for being here. And any further comments? Okay. I think that completes our list of people signed up to testify on HJR 32. Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on HJR 32? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on HJR 32. And seeing nothing further to come before us, committee members, we are adjourned. Thank you.